Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A defensive Michael Brown, the former head of FEMA, told Congress today that before Hurricane Katrina struck last month, his agency did everything it could to prepare for the storm. And while he admitted to the mistake of not ordering troops into the region sooner, he said much of the blame is local.
My biggest mistake was not recognizing by Saturday that Louisiana was dysfunctional.
Joining us on the line now, Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, you heard that comment. You've been listening to the hearings. What jumps out at you?
Well, there are fingers pointing in all directions in this hearing, and I think that would be the first point to make. Mr. Brown sounded conspicuously not prepared for these hearings. When asked the lead question, what his mistakes were, he noted, as you said, problems with dysfunctional Louisiana, but his first comments were that he'd failed to set up regular briefings with the media, that he'd gone to the news shows, that that was a mistake, and that he was unable to explain to the governor and the mayor that they needed to sit down and resolve their differences. This is not what this committee needed to hear. They needed to hear that there were specific things that the federal government could have done that it didn't do. And so from the beginning, he put himself at odds, interestingly enough, with the Republicans on the committee and obviously as well as the several Democrats who did participate.
I want to hear more about that response, but let's listen to a little more of what Michael Brown said along the lines of what you just mentioned.
But I do believe there are a couple of specific mistakes that I made that I want to put on the table right now. First, I failed initially to set up a series of regular briefings to the media about what FEMA was doing throughout the Gulf Coast region. And instead, I became tied to the news shows, going on the news shows early in the morning and late at night, and that was just a mistake. We should have been feeding that information to the press instead of and in the manner and in the time that we wanted to, instead of letting the press drive us. Second, I very strongly, personally regret that I was unable to persuade Governor Blanco and Mayor Nagin to sit down, get over their differences, and work together. I just couldn't pull that off.
Gail Chadwick, as we listen to Michael Brown speaking at today's hearings, how did the members of the panel respond to what he was saying?
Well, what's interesting about this panel was who wasn't there. Your listeners may know that Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader, doesn't like the way this has been set up. She doesn't feel that Republicans ought to be investigating a Republican administration with gavels in their hands, that this ought to be an independent commission like the 9/11 commission. And so missing from this panel are some of the very skillful questioners, investigators on the Democratic side, most notably the ranking member, Henry Waxman, who was not there. But you did have, so far, Gene Taylor from Mississippi, William Jefferson from Louisiana. Charlie Melanson is coming in later, I understand. They both had very emotional exchanges with the former FEMA director, pressing him on why there were not, for example, more resources in place. Gene Taylor, who lost his house in the hurricane, where were the radios? Where were the food? Where was the food? Did you anticipate that people would have to loot from Walmart to get a change of clothing? We're talking here about first responders. Mm. And what it comes down to in the end, and I think what's important about this hearing, is what is the notion of the federal government? What is expected? Mr. Brown repeatedly has said, my job was to coordinate, not to federalize. Don't expect me to provide security or to bring food, or that's not my job. My job is to get the locals talking to each other and doing it.
So it seems as if the issue here is federalism.
It is.
In his mind.
I really think in the end of it, obviously he is a scapegoat of sorts. He's going to take responsibility for this, and it's funny, it's interesting that the Republicans on the panel had to press him, did you get all the assets from the Department of Homeland Security and the White House in a timely manner? Yes, he said. That was his first answer. And then later on, the chairman, Davis, came back at him and said, are you sure you got the assets you needed in a timely manner? No, he said. And then later on went on to say, how decimated FEMA was and how unhappy he was that he wasn't able to support the agency more. Well, that's an important distinction. Either they got the resources they needed or they didn't. Congress is going to look into that. Should FEMA be pulled out of the Department of Homeland Security and rebuilt to its former respected status?
Gail Chadwick, we're going to be speaking later in the program about the story of David Safafian, another high-ranking Bush administration official who was recently arrested in a completely different case. But his job involved Katrina relief contracts, and many are saying that the issue here, in addition to federalism, might be cronyism. The fact that people whose resumes weren't up to snuff were put in these jobs, at least in critics' point of view. In the minute we have, did that word, cronyism, come up, or questions about Michael Brown's resume?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, he defended himself, his resume. He said that there was a lot of misrepresentation about it. But cronyism is the theme that's underlying all of this now. You'll note on the Senate side, there are at least one appointment that's being held up on that very grounds. Is this individual qualified for the job they're being asked to take on, and cronyism is the unspoken theme in all of this. Yeah. Even with Republicans holding the gavel, it's an issue that is just too hot to avoid.
Gail Chadwick, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, following today's hearings into the slow response to Katrina. Gail Chadwick, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, as Congress investigates the initial slow response to Katrina, environmental activists are worried that the subsequent recovery effort has been too hurried and that environmental regulations are being railroaded in the haste to rebuild. Becky Gillette is an environmental writer and Mississippi Sierra Club volunteer. She joins us first on the line from Ocean Springs, Mississippi. Welcome, Becky.
It's unrecognizable to those of us who've lived here for many years because you actually get lost because none of the familiar landmarks are there, and almost half of our housing stock is gone or damaged, places for people to live. And so, of course, every home had, lawnmowers and paint cans, and, so there's a great deal of concern just about the waste from all those homes.
That's right.
And then with the environmental cost of rebuilding them all. And then we have these huge trailer projects planned now. We had been fighting a wetland spill in North Gulfport, a minority community, for about the last 6 years. Thought we had won, and now there's a proposal to put a couple thousand trailers on those wetlands. And they're trying to get, an emergency permit again. And so they're just saying, well, let's forget about the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act, and we just got to do what we got to do to get back getting homes for people. But if they go in and fill in those wetlands, then all of these low-income minority community that didn't flood in Katrina is going to flood next time. And we had an issue with the Port of Gulfport several years ago had decided to expand 40 acres into the Mississippi Sound. They filled in the Mississippi Sound to make a great big parking lot for the containers that are shipped on the sea and then put on tractor-trailer rigs for highway. And during the storm, these containers broke loose and actually became torpedoes that started ramming into people's houses and knocking them down.
Remind us, how big are these containers? What do they look
like? They're like what you would see on a tractor trailer rig, an 18-wheeler.
Mm-hmm. Environmentalists across the country have been complaining about harbors being taken over by these container ships delivering all the goods that are being shipped to big stores around the country. But we understand that the owners of these containers, Crowley Liner Services and Dole and Chiquita, say in an editorial in your Sun Herald today that preparations were taken as Katrina approached the coast.
Well, evidently, they said that they tied a bunch of them together, and they thought that that would help. But they, they obviously that didn't work, and they broke loose.
Well, and we understand that some of them contain rotting chicken and pork.
Yes, you can imagine what these products smell like after a month in the heat of South Mississippi.
Well, what's happening with them?
Well, unfortunately, they took some of it, of this to a landfill over in the county where I live on the other side of the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and the stench was so bad that it just drove out everybody in the neighborhood over there.
Aren't there laws about what you can put in landfills?
Yes, there are, and this landfill was not licensed and didn't have a permit for municipal solid waste of this nature. But since the hurricane, the Mississippi Department of Environmental Quality has issued a number of emergency stays where they're basically not enforcing pollution laws or allowing variances to the pollution laws in order to deal with the problem. Not only on the state level have they decided basically to have a vacation from enforcing pollution laws, but we now have a federal legislation in Congress that would allow EPA to override Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, et cetera, for 18 months.
Do you understand, Becky, that some state officials have decided better to get it done fast, get those rotting chickens, for instance, somewhere because of the magnitude of the situation and maybe adjust the laws back later?
Well, I'm sure that's what they're saying. What we're saying is even with this debris removal that it needs to be done properly in order not to add insult to injury.
Where else are you seeing problems, environmental problems?
Well, one of our biggest concerns is about industrial sites that were flooded, and there was one that was directly in the eye of the worst damage over on the Bay of St. Louis, DuPont DeLille. For a number of years, this has been the number one facility in the country for dioxin releases. In 2002, they were responsible for 42% of the dioxin releases reported on the toxic release inventory in the entire country. Well, this plant was subject to this 25 to 30-foot storm surge. Mm-hmm. Well, DuPont said after the storm that they had no indication of any environmental releases. So we have not even had any testing of these areas surrounding this chemical plant, residential areas, the DeLille Elementary School, which was cleaned up and which is going to be put back into use for these children without even being tested for the dioxin, arsenic, and other heavy metals that were known to be in those waste pits. The floodwaters that were on the plant property, they did admit they had 7 to 9 feet of floodwaters on there, where they were allowed to discharge that into the Bay of St. Louis, only monitoring for pH, which is, acid, a basic balance, and an oil sheen. They weren't required to even monitor for dioxin, PCBs, cadmium, lead, mercury, arsenic, all of those things. So they just sort of get a free ride on discharging all that pollution into the bay, which, of course, was already inundated with the storm surge. When the storm surge left and went out, it sucked out a great deal of garbage into the Mississippi Sound. It's littered literally with thousands of tons of debris.
It just must smell like heck.
Oh, the stench is awful, and the flies, the blowflies, the biting flies are multiplying like crazy. It smells bad. You can even, taste it in your mouth.
Becky Gillette is speaking to us from Ocean Springs, Mississippi. She's an environmental reporter in the area. Becky, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
And just ahead, President Bush tours refineries in Texas while Republicans in Congress push to relax environmental regulations on oil and gas. And don't forget, later in the program, South Carolina author Sue Monk Kidd, she had two bestsellers this past summer. Much more ahead, coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking about the environment in the wake of Katrina and Rita. We heard just now about local concerns, and we want to branch out a bit to look at national proposals to relax regulations on refineries and oil production. Yesterday, President Bush listed several ideas that he said would help boost production. He mentioned again this September 13th temporary waiver on winter blend fuel. He also pledged to take steps to make it easier for oil and gas refiners and producers to boost capacity. Today, he's reinforcing this message with a tour of refineries in Texas. Back in Washington, D.C., Republican leaders in Congress are jumping back into the heated energy debate, proposing bills that would relax environmental regulations for refineries. These measures include a bill to encourage construction of new refineries on former military bases. Another measure would require the EPA to allow refiners to modify their facilities without triggering anti-pollution controls required by the Clean Air Act. While the industry and environmentalists gear up for a fight, many are asking why refining capacity is so strained. We're joined now by Ron Gold, Vice President of the Petroleum Industry Research Foundation, an industry-funded organization, and he joins us from his office in New York City. Ron, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's start with the refining capacity. We know a lot has been lost. How much, and why is that so important? Remind us.
Well, we... First of all, the refining capacity around the world has been very tight, and in the U.S. as well. So the losses come at a very tough time, where it's expensive and tough to shop the market for replacement supplies. By and large, it looks like we've lost maybe 10 to 15%, 20% of our refining capacity. Not necessarily lost forever, but basically shut down. Awaiting inspection, much of it, and fairly reasonably quick return to production.
Well, as you know, a lot of people are seizing on, perhaps their own reasons for there being less refining capacity. We read today in the Wall Street Journal that some Republican leaders are proposing legislation to relax environmental regulations on refineries. They claim that these environmental rules have directly contributed to the limited capacity. But what do you think? Are the environmental rules to blame, or is it economics?
Well, you might say a mix of both. If you go back for the past few years, refining generally had been a very low profit industry, and one where basically you could have put your money in the bank and earn a higher return than you would in the refining business.
Again, the oil comes in, and the oil is where the money is, but then it goes through the refining process, which, as you say...
Well, basically, among the major companies, all the excitement and interest was basically in finding and producing oil and gas. And refining, was a relatively low-profit business, again, especially relative to crude, if you could find it and develop it.
Well, in fact, some are saying that the industry wanted to keep a small amount of refineries because there was so little profit in it, and that would raise the price of gas.
Well, I don't think that's... I think they were shutting down some of the more marginal refineries, but basically a number of the majors unloaded refineries at distressed prices to what have since become very large, independent, and extremely profitable refiners who bought them at distressed prices. They turned out to have been very shrewd, and their timing was excellent, and they're making a bundle of money.
Right. So where is the economics? Just to make sure we've made that point, where do you think the economics might play a part in the
refineries?
Well,
the economics play the part in that as long as it looked like this was extremely low-profit industry with not great prospects for improvement, no one would be busy planning and fighting to make major expansions or new grassroots refining. So I think what you could say is that the economics were not favorable, and then you had on top of it things that were keeping up expenses, namely the cost of permitting, the cost of compliance with environmental regulations, that would sort of add a certain expense. Now, the industry was investing, and capacity was growing very slowly increasing, but a lot of this was basically investment to stay in business and investment to comply with new requirements for fuels.
Right. And as you and others have said, there's also the sort of not in my backyard thing. Nobody wants a refinery. A few people do want it in their backyard, especially when they see these pictures after a hurricane. So what are your thoughts about proposals to put refineries on, let's say, former military bases?
Well, there are two things. It's going to be hard to build a new grassroots refinery almost any place you pick. I can't imagine that Fort Dix, New Jersey, would be an agreed-upon site with no problems. You have to find the right military base, where it's easy to get the crude in, easy to get the product out, and where you don't have major objections and where you're not in an air quality non-attainment area. These are tough things to put together. The real improvements may come through refining expansions.
Well,
where you don't have to fight for a grassroots site.
Well, I want to ask you about that because others are saying, let's think differently. We're speaking with Ron Gold, Vice President of the Petroleum Industry Research Foundation. And in the couple minutes we have, 4 out of 5 Americans, including 76% of Republicans surveyed, according to the Opinion Research Corporation, say they would approve a tax on the windfall profits of oil companies if those tax monies were spent on alternative energy resources, something environmentalists would obviously support. So do you see the industry responding to what we're seeing post these hurricanes and maybe making a huge shift or just continuing to build more refineries as some of the Republicans are proposing?
Well, any shift to alternative fuels is going to take a very long time frame to have a significant impact. That if you're going to look to solar, you're going to look to wind, small hydro, and so forth, these are very small sources. Even after a number of years of certain tax for favorable treatment, this country is going to be relying on oil and gas for many, many years to come. There are things that can be done to sort of maybe limit or contain the use. There are things that can be done to improve the supply. But there's not much realistic prospect of moving away rapidly from our need for oil. So I think those who think you can really stop all the efforts involved in improving the supply situation, acting to a certain extent on demand, are really misleading people.
Ron Gold, Vice President of the Petroleum Industry Research Foundation, on a topic that's going to be much discussed in the coming weeks in the wake of Katrina and Rita, what to do about the offshore refineries. Ron Gold, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As we said earlier, the former head of FEMA, Michael Brown, is testifying today before Congress on the federal response to Hurricane Katrina. Brown was criticized early on for being a political appointee with little experience in disaster relief. Well, now that charge is being made against another administration official, David Safavian, whose resume has also been questioned. The Bush administration's former top procurement official is charged with obstructing a criminal investigation into the Republican lobby Jack Abramoff's dealings with the federal government. David Safavian was arrested on September 19th, 3 days after he resigned from his job, which included overseeing contract policies related to the Katrina relief effort. Newsweek correspondent Michael Isikoff writes about this in the October 3rd issue of that magazine, and he joins us now. Michael, walk us through the story. Who is David Safavian?
David Safavian is a former lobbyist in Washington, an associate of Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist who's been at the center of a Justice Department criminal investigation for some time.
What's Jack Abramoff charged with?
He has been charged in Miami with wire fraud and conspiracy charges relating to a business deal to buy a casino in Miami. But at the moment, he hasn't been charged with anything in Washington. He is the target of a criminal investigation into allegations he ripped off tens of millions of dollars from his Indian tribal clients and diverted the money into personal and political causes. There's been much testimony before the Senate. Senator McCain's Indian Affairs Committee has held a series of hearings on this. Safavian was a partner of his, not in any of the Indian tribal issues that have been the subject of the Senate hearings, but when President Bush was elected, Safavian landed a job as first the chief of staff of the General Services Administration, and then later as a relatively senior position as the director of federal procurement policies at the Office of Management and Budget, which makes him a relatively senior White House official, or did until he left a week or so ago.
So if David Safavian isn't being accused of having anything to do with Abramoff's casino dealings, why has he then been arrested?
Well, he was a former associate of Abramoff, and in the spring of 2002, while he's at the General Services Administration, Safavian is invited to participate in a golfing jaunt that Abramoff had organized for a member of Congress, Robert Ney. This was quite an expensive golfing jaunt, $100,000 to the world-famous St. Andrews course in Scotland. Safavian, as a federal government employee, sought approval from the ethics officer of the General Services Administration. Can I take this trip to Scotland, sponsored by a lobbyist? The ethics officer said yes. It turns out that Safavian omitted a rather pertinent detail when he sought that approval, that Abramoff, at the time, had dealings with the General Services Administration, in fact, was seeking Safavian's help in leasing properties from the General Services Administration, the government, that Abramoff was seeking to lease. Safavian did not disclose this initially.
That Safavian was going on a golfing trip with a lobbyist who had business before a federal agency.
Before his agency, mm-hmm. Safavian's agency, and in fact that Abramoff was seeking Safavian's help. This anonymous tipster complained about this to the Inspector General of the General Services Administration. They launched an inquiry. Safavian is questioned by the Inspector General and denies that Abramoff has any business before the GSA. Later, the FBI launches its own investigation into this when they begin their investigation of Abramoff, and they again question Safavian, and he again denies that Abramoff has any business dealings before the GSA. It turns out that the FBI had the goods on this to show, according to the feds anyway, that Safavian wasn't telling the truth. In fact, there were multiple email exchanges between Abramoff and Safavian about arranging meetings that would help Abramoff secure these two leasing deals that he was seeking, one of which was to lease the old post office on Pennsylvania Avenue, right in across the street, as it turned out, from Abramoff's restaurant in Washington. Safavian did not disclose this, and as a result, he was charged last week with lying to the FBI and obstructing a criminal investigation into Abramoff.
We're talking to Newsweek investigative correspondent Michael Isikoff about the arrest of David Safavian, a former high-ranking Bush administration official. And Michael, this all comes at a time when the hurricane relief effort is underway. David Safavian's job is in the contracting policies relating to the relief effort. Your colleagues at Time magazine write that a dozen procurement experts they interviewed said that David Safavian was the most unqualified person to hold that job since its creation in 1974.
Well, certainly if you look at his resume, as I say, primarily as a lobbyist for a number of clients associate of Jack Abramoff, that would not leap out at you as making him an expert in federal procurement policies. And so some have drawn analogies with Michael Brown and some other Bush administration officials who appear to have gotten their jobs through political connections rather than qualifications. That's hardly unprecedented in the annals of the federal government. It happens in every administration. But there are other shoes to drop, I should point out, on this Abramoff case, because, as I said before, that golfing junket was primarily organized not for Safavian, although he was clearly seems to have been invited for business purposes by Abramoff, but for a member of Congress, Robert May, who's right smack in the middle of this of the Abramoff investigation. He was the he is the chairman of the House Administration Committee, a member of the House leadership. This is significant because Abramoff actually organized a number of these trips, including one 2 years earlier for Tom DeLay, the House Majority Leader, who has also been under fire in the Abramoff case. And I think that one of the things we're going to see, or we're seeing, is a greater Justice Department scrutiny of Abramoff's dealings, which could end up touching on these very senior members of Congress.
Well, I wonder, Michael Isikoff, if there's also another shoe to drop with David Safavian, given that he was working in the Katrina relief effort in the contracts division, and there have been questions about the contracts. Do you think that there will be a closer light shining on those and his role in them?
Well, certainly given his notoriety as a result of this arrest, which is a rather extraordinary thing on its face, to have a White House official arrested by the FBI. That doesn't happen every day of the week. I think it's going to certainly lead to greater scrutiny of Safavian's actions in Katrina relief.
Newsweek investigative correspondent Michael Isikoff, he writes in the October 3rd issue of the magazine about the arrest of David Safavian. Mike, thanks for speaking with us.
Okay, anytime.
And still to come, author Sue Monk Kidd, a Christian writer, writing about affairs, a mystical mermaid chair, and the life of bees. You're listening to Here and Now. The Boston Red Sox are performing their traditional late-season gymnastic moves, tumbling from their five-game lead in the American League East to fall half a game behind the Yankees. The Yankees play Baltimore tonight. The Sox play a doubleheader against Toronto today, which means the town's emergency rooms should have a breather. That's because a new study shows that Red Sox fever actually affects attendance in emergency rooms. Joining us with more, Children's Hospital Boston doctors Ben Rice.
Hey, how you doing?
And John Brownstein.
Hi there.
And we're joined also by Dr. Kenneth Mandel. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, I'm fine. Now, there have been a lot of urban legends about televised events coinciding with human behavior. You know, there's an urban legend that sewer pipes break when everybody gets up at once to go to the bathroom after the Super Bowl. That, by the way, is fictional. But apparently, John, you and Ben started with this idea of finding out if it was fact that people don't go to the emergency room during the Red Sox game. How did you proceed?
Previous literature has shown that there is an effect of major sporting events on emergency department volume. What we were able to show here is that there was an actual relationship between the importance of a game, in this case it's the Red Sox, and the numbers of emergency department visits.
So, Ben, you started tracking who was actually watching the games?
Exactly. We used our local public health surveillance system, and we tracked the numbers of people going to the emergency rooms during the actual playoff games and World Series games.
And let's review. This is a seven-game series that the Red Sox had, first with the Yankees, who they roundly defeated in the playoffs, and then moved on to beat St. Louis in four games.
Exactly.
Then we bring Dr. Kenneth Mandel in to help you with your research. What was your contribution, Ken?
For the past 5 years, we've been working here at the Children's Hospital Informatics Program to develop technologies that enable us to detect outbreaks of disease in real time. And we do this using feeds of data from emergency departments and primary care clinics all over the region.
So if a whole bunch of people came into the emergency room, you would follow something like that?
Exactly. We're very interested in tracking emerging infections like avian flu. We're interested in tracking the possibility of bioterrorism. So it's really been very enjoyable for us to turn this technology on a more enjoyable problem.
Which is Red Sox fever.
Which is the Red Sox fever.
It brings us back to John Brownstein. In addition to the data that Dr. Kenneth Mandel was collecting and the data from the cameras that are in the emergency rooms, you now had also Nielsen activity. How many people were watching television? What'd you find?
We found that on the most important games, up to 60% of Boston households were actually tuned in to Red Sox games. What we found was that that really had a significant impact on the number of visits.
Because simultaneously what, Ben? What happens in emergency rooms when so many people are watching the Red Sox?
We found, surprisingly, that the more people watching the games, the fewer people coming to the emergency rooms. And we actually found that the more exciting games, the more important games, like Game 7 of the ALCS when the Red Sox beat the Yankees to get into the World Series, and Game 4 of the World Series where the Red Sox actually clinched the title and broke the curse after 86 years, those more exciting, more important games had higher TV viewership and lower ED volume.
In contrast, when the Red Sox were really stinking up the place?
Yeah, when they were facing elimination halfway through the series against the Yankees, fewer people were watching the games, there being a lower probability at that point that the Red Sox would actually make it to the World Series.
So more people were going to emergency rooms when the Red Sox were terrible.
Exactly.
Which could be because they were, like, sick to their stomach over it.
Maybe. We don't claim to know the source of all these ailments, but we just report the facts as we see them.
Well, and I guess, John, that is the question. This is potentially very troubling. Do you know? I mean, are people very sick and not going because they want to see the game, or are we finding out that this is revealing that people go to the emergency room when they're not that sick?
We have two hypotheses. One is that people are at home watching the game, so they're not necessarily outside and potentially getting into accidents. The other is that people are deciding whether or not to come into the emergency department, and the Red Sox game is a factor, actually, in that decision-making process.
Well, and the third possibility could be that, you know, someone's sitting there holding a broken arm and just won't go until the game's over.
Ken, you want to take that?
Yeah, well, I think all of these things probably come into play, and this is a phenomenon that emergency physicians have observed for decades.
Given the overburdened emergency rooms, I bet I know who you're rooting for. Or would you be anyway?
Yeah.
We're definitely rooting for the Red Sox.
Yeah,
well, I want to thank you all for telling us about your research.
Thank you very much.
Sure, thanks so much.
Children's Hospital Boston doctors Ben Rice, John Brownstein, and Kenneth Mandel. Their research showing that when the Red Sox get hot, emergency rooms are not, appears in the new edition of Annals of Emergency Medicine. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Sue Monk Kidd's novel, The Secret Life of Bees, was on the New York Times bestseller list for 80 weeks. Now it's found a home on the paperback list as well. It's sold more than 3.5 million copies, been adapted for the stage, and it's being turned into a film. Her new novel, The Mermaid Chair, is very comfortably ensconced on the hardcover bestseller list. It spent most of its summer vacation there. It is Sue Monk Kidd's world, and we just live in it.
In the middle of my marriage, when I was, above all, Hugh's wife and Dee's mother, one of those unambiguous women with no desire to disturb the universe, I fell in love with a Benedictine monk. I marvel at how good I was before I met him, how I lived molded to the smallest space possible, my days the size of little beads that passed without passion through my fingers. So few people know what they're capable of. At 42, I'd never done anything that took my own breath away, and I suppose now that was part of the problem, my chronic inability to astonish myself. I promise you, no one judges me more harshly than I do myself. I caused a brilliant wreckage. Some say I fell from grace. They're being kind. I didn't fall. I dove.
Author Sue Monk Kidd reading from her new novel, The Mermaid Chair, and she joins us now from Charleston, South Carolina, to tell us more. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin. It's nice to be with you.
And it was nice to be reminded of Jesse Sullivan, your protagonist's thoughts at the beginning of The Mermaid Chair. Jesse, her daughter Dee away at Vanderbilt, her husband Hugh breathing by her side, the cadence of her life when the phone rings. She flashes back to a terrible boat accident that killed her father when she was 9 and thinks it was her fault. That phone call pulls her to an island off the coast of South Carolina where her mother still lives and upends her life. As you said, she doesn't fall, she dives. Where did Jessie come from?
Mostly out of some mysterious trap door in my imagination, because it's not so much based autobiographically or on people that I know. I do think that there is my own emotional truth lives somewhere in this story, and that some of my own worldview perhaps lives somewhere here. But
Some readers will want to know, is it you?
No, Jesse, it's not I. You know, I felt like when I discovered Jesse that I could tell a story of transformation and renewal at midlife, which is something I know a little bit about, having gone through my own kind of awakening and redefinition at midlife. But I do think that Jesse's story is much more dramatic and far different from mine. No, I didn't fall in love with a monk.
Well, and that is at the center of it. And you know, it raises another question, because you've written Christian books in the past, including When the Heart Waits, A Spiritual Direction for Life's Sacred Questions and God's Joyful Surprise. And here you have Jesse falling, tumbling for a Benedictine monk.
Yes. Well, you know, the image at the core of this novel is a mermaid chair, which the title picks up on. That is how the whole book started. It started with this vivid image that came into my mind of a chair which had the carved arms of on the chair were mermaids, and it was sitting in a church. And there was something very provocative about that for me, the fact that this pairing of a mermaid in a church. What is she doing in there? And I kept trying to play with that idea. And the more I let that image burrow down in my imagination, the more I began to have a story germinate out of it. And it had to do with the sensual and with the spiritual. It had to do with how we reconcile these two natures in our lives. And then the character came to me, this 42-year-old. She's often needing to redefine herself, to renew her life, and to find a new way to be a woman. And that's where Jessie was. So this is the story of how she did it. Now, my character did it in a most dangerous and treacherous way. But the real message or heart of the story for me is that there is this journey often to be made at midlife, and it can be incredibly beautiful and fertile for a woman.
Well, and the journey is an erotic one, but it's also a mystical one. I mean, there's a lot of mysticism. I wondered, given that it's an island off the coast of South Carolina, and there's a character who speaks Gullah, how much of it was sort of the mystic lore that you heard about?
Well, the setting for the novel is fictional in that it is called a place called Egret Island, a little barrier island. And yet there are many of these islands around South Carolina near where I live. And so it's a composite, in a way, of many of these places where you have to cross over on a ferry, and you can't have cars, but you drive around in golf carts. So it's that world, and there is a Gullah culture that permeates these barrier islands in South Carolina, and it's quite remarkable, and that is, it is a repository of slave history and sort of leftover African tradition. So it's got its own language and food, and I do think there is something mystical about that landscape. It's a very sensual, even erotic landscape with the marshes and these old gnarled oaks and moss, and it's an exotic world.
You know, it's funny, the South Carolina as character appears in the life of Bees as well. And there's another parallel, the young girl who also thinks that as a child, she accidentally caused the death of her mother. Jessie, your character in Mermaid Chair, feels she accidentally caused the death of her father. What is that storyline?
I think my parents would like to know the answer to that question also. I don't know. I've got to stop that, Robin. I've got to stop writing about this. But I think it was much more of a primary question in The Secret Life of Bees, Lily's journey to resolve this incredible guilt. So maybe I have now exhausted my need to explore that emotional content. But, you know, my theory as a novelist is that you take a bad situation and you make it worse. So how do you make something worse when a parent dies? Well, the way to make that worse, of course, is that the child is somehow implicated in it and carries the guilt of it.
But then there has to be redemption. Does there have to be redemption? I mean, being, you know, how much does your Christian writing cross-pollinate with your fictional writing?
I do feel strongly about bringing some sense of hope or redemption or resolution to my stories. I'd like to bring a little magical realism into it all so that we are left with a sense of the potential and the power and the possibility of life. You know, someone told me one time that the only theme or for a novel or any story that was worth anything was love conquers all. And I sort of smiled at that. But then I thought, you know what, maybe they're right.
Well, Soo-Mun Kid, I'm sure fiction writers everywhere are saying, will you please get off the bestseller list and make a spot for them? But I'm wondering if the opposite is true. Are you working on another book?
Well, I am. I've got two books in my pipeline, a nonfiction book followed by my third novel. My next book, however, is a memoir. It's going to be written with my daughter. It's a spiritual story. It's about feminine passages. It's about spiritual places and a mother-daughter tale in there as well. Mm.
Soo-Mun Kid, author of the best-selling The Mermaid Chair and The Secret Life of Bees, which still is on the New York Times bestseller list in a paperback and soon to be a movie. Sue, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.